This episode is brought to you by Home Team Inspection Service. When you partner with Home Team, you're getting more than a home inspection. You're delivering the home team experience. With a team approach, fast turnarounds, and package options that include home inspection warranties, Home Team helps real estate pros stand out. Plus, many locations now offer pay at close, giving your clients flexibility when they need it most. Schedule your next inspection with confidence at hometeam.com.
And we need to be thinking about when we get our income, our paycheck, our 1099, whatever that is, the first thing should be, how do I take a portion of my money and make it work for me?
Well, welcome back, friends, to another fantastic episode of the Color of Money podcast. It's Julia Lachey, and I am here with my two favorite brothers. I say that no matter which two it is of the three, but today is Bo and Emric. Of course, y'all know him as Unc. And we've got a special guest with us today from my hometown, from the city of Minneapolis. And his name is Mr. PJ Hill. PJ Hill is a financial advisor, but not just a financial advisor. I'm going to read it like that so he can introduce exactly what he is to us. But he's a financial advisor with North Rock Partners and the current vice president of the Minneapolis chapter of the NAACP. He's deeply committed in our community. He's an advocate, a member. He holds a number of leadership roles at a number of local nonprofits that are here in the city of Minneapolis, including Just a Position, Southside Initiatives, the George Floyd Worldwide Healing Hands Project, so on and so forth. He has a decade of success, not just a decade in it, but a decade of success in building exceptional businesses, partnerships, and lasting relationships. He has a network of professional athletes. He was, in fact, a professional athlete himself. He did 10 years in the professional world of basketball, and he helps clients with new acquisition, targeted strategies, so on. And today, PJ is here because I ran into him at a local NARAB meeting, the National Association of Real Estate Brokers, the Black Real Estate Association, if you will. And he came in and he did a 30, 45 minute, I called it a masterclass on wealth and wealth building. And so I invited him to come and be our guest today because everything he was saying, we need to hear here. In fact, that's what this podcast is entirely about. So Mr. PJ Hill, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yes, excited to have you. And best of all, I just found out that his mama is one of my favorite people in the entire world. Sweetest lady in the world. Someday, if I was sweet, I would be just like her. Yeah.
She would love that. She would love that. I'm gonna make sure I tell her that.
Yes. Welcome, PJ. Tell us what you do exactly. I kind of gave a bio, but what does all of that mean? And what do you actually do in the world of wealth building?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to be on this podcast. I mean, I like to start out with my mission. My mission in life is to make 1,000 women and Black people multimillionaires. And that is through the capital markets, through the private markets, through real estate, through entrepreneurship, through innovation, whatever it may be, just, you know, helping people from the community level the economic playing field and be, you know, economically liberated from systems that have oppressed us for so long. So I am working at an RIA at a multifamily office. So the difference between a traditional advisor, traditionally a person will have their financial advisor at one firm, they'll have their tax professional at another firm, their attorney at another firm. So what we do at North Rock Partners is we have all of those people in-house. So you truly get an integrated strategy across all areas of your financial life. So I'll never make a decision without having your CPA, your tax attorney, your estate attorney, your investment professional all in the room. We build these integrated strategies. And this is what the wealthiest families in America have done. Formerly, I came from Wells Fargo Private Bank, and I can do that. But you're only managing a small portion of somebody's assets, which is just the assets that they have on your platform. But I wanted to be able to go broader, go deeper, and really think about generational wealth and how you pass that from Gen 1 to Gen 2, Gen 2 to Gen 3. And so what had hence led me here to now building and running family offices. So very, very fulfilling job. I've learned a lot about finance. And now how do I disseminate this information and knowledge that I have to the general masses?
That's awesome. Now I'm going to ask you a question about your intro. You said your mission was to help, was it 100 or 1,000?
1,000.
1,000 women and Black people. Why women and Black people? Because some people listening to this podcast might say, well, PJ, that's racist.
No.
Why would you want to help women and Black people?
Yeah, I see Unc shaking his head. No, I mean, I think there's, for me, this is just where my ethos and my mission have driven me. Me having seven sisters and being from the community and watching like my sister who played in the WNBA, who has an equal skill set as her male counterparts, me being, but being significantly underpaid. So how can I help bridge that gap for women and people like my mom who have been in other professions? And then when George Floyd happened, I was already in finance and I was doing very well working at the private bank. But then that really kind of changed something within me. I seen that I could be much better and be more beneficial to the community than I was, because I've always been in the community from a sports perspective, doing camps. I have teams. I own a gym here in town. But how can I really make a lasting difference? So if I feel like I can bring $1 billion of assets to a community, that'll change the trajectory of a community, or at least the few people that I'm helping. It's like a starfish mentality. If I throw you back in the ocean, I'll change your life forever. So that's kind of my genesis. There's a lot of other race and a lot of other people focusing on that. But this is, as for me and mine, this is what I'm doing.
You know, got it. And I absolutely love that, PJ. We're kindred souls, because mine is 1,000 Black people or people in my space to earn $300,000 a year consistently.
Oh, I love that.
And the whole thought is that would change the whole trajectory of their life and their lineage. Because mm-hmm. their level of the amount of disposable income changes for them to invest and do other things in their world. So when you said that, it struck a chord with me. And I understand exactly where you're coming from in your mission.
Talk to us a little bit about how you think about, when you think about that mission, that big vision, you said to make people multimillionaires. How do you think about wealth creation? And I think you could focus at so many different levels. And I think that's the beautiful part. And that's always what's inspired me about some of the conversations being able to have with Emmerich. Like, where do you see yourself playing with a specific individual, a specific family, at a specific place in their journey? How do you see that working?
Yeah, that's a great question, Bo. I've kind of wrestled with how to get that at scale. And this is my life's work, so I know it's going to take an entire lifetime, or I may be able to do it faster. So originally, how I had thought about it, like if I think about it from a community level, not many people have trust in the financial markets and all of that. So it's really the genesis of it is based in education and how can I get people more comfortable with just investing in the markets, being able to have their money be their number one employee. And even if you don't have a lot, it's more about the principles and the percentages. And then also, I think if I think of from a community level, it's more of entrepreneurship and then your IP, like your innovation and things that you can do. So a lot of our people have small businesses and have tremendous skill set, but don't have the business acumen to be able to scale their skill set or to go along their skill set that they're serving to the world. So that's how I think about it from a community level. If I'm thinking about it at a broader level, I read an article in the Wall Street Journal about NVIDIA, Vincent Wong, and he talked about that 7,900 of his employees have over $1 million in their account because of how well NVIDIA has done. So he has built an incredible company, has given them equity, and then allowed them to grow. And about 1/3 of those have over $20 million. So then it popped, boom, dawned on me that if I want to really do this at scale, then I need to build platforms, build companies, and then allow people to participate in the economic upside by giving them ownership. So not employing folks, but deploying folks. And so whether it's me on the side having a development company similar to yourself and then hiring people in different verticals in that and allowing them to participate in ownership. But what I want to do is be able to scale that at mass. And so there's a lot of different levels to it. It's really hard to pinpoint one way. But if you're doing like hand-to-hand combat, working with just one client at a time, it's going to be very hard to get there. So I'm trying to do it in a scalable manner so I can impact more people. I hope that answered your question, Bo.
Yeah. And how do you think about a platform? What are the components of a platform that allows people to deploy and do that?
Yeah. So great question. So I'll just talk about maybe my PGMA development company. So originally I was doing it with one other partner, you know, acquiring, you know, 30 to 100 unit buildings and then scaling like that. And then I started to see, look, I had a Black banker who I was working with. they were on the other side of the table. I had a black title company that, you know, was helping me out do some of the closing, a black insurance agent. So what I started to say, I had an owner's rep. I did a development project, had an owner's rep who was mixing, who helped me with a lot, but they were all working for other companies. So I had one big project that I was looking at doing, and I went to all of these people and I said, hey, instead of you guys working for me on my behalf and being paid, how about y'all participate in the economic upside? I'll give y'all a small slice of the pie and y'all do this with me. You guys have all of the skill set. I can employ y'all, but how about y'all be with me? It's a little bit sacrifice for me giving up some of the upside, but I think it's for the greater good of being able to take these people from the other side of the table and put them on my side of the table and then really help them participate in the economic growth of what I'm trying to do. So that's how I've done it. And I just continue to do that. So I have a number of buildings right now. I need my buildings cleaned. So I ended up hiring my cousin, say, look, here's how they're doing it. I'll go 50-50 with the company with you. And just trying to vertically integrate at every single level of different things that I'm doing. And that's how I'm giving people opportunity, kind of through procurement.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you said something. You said you might be losing something. You're not losing anything. You're not taking a step back. You're actually taking a step forward. Mm-hmm. Because in that space of sharing, what happens is it opens your mind up to other possibilities and it allows you to think differently, which ultimately invite more people in your world and have the opportunity to create a bigger world.
Mm-hmm.
And you create a bigger world that people would never want to leave.
Yeah.
It's interesting, you know, we oftentimes do such a good job of fighting to start up a business, to create an opportunity, to create a thing. And yet so much of the world of wealth, money, and opportunity moves in ecosystems. And so you just heard PJ talk about, well, when I was able to control a development and I was actually at the top of that food chain, I could make sure that there were multiple opportunities for people to eat along the way. And I think we oftentimes talk about like, oh, we didn't have access to capital, we have access to this. What we really didn't have access to oftentimes is being in the ecosystem where the dollars are, where the dollars are moving. And, you know, the space you're coming from in this family office space is one of those spaces that helps to think about how those families generate wealth, but the ways in which that wealth is generate create whole ecosystems. So, you know, if you thought the guy owning the building was at the top, he got to pick the architect, he got to pick who cleans. Well, there was someone above him who decided where the money was even going to go into real estate, and that their 15% of their money was going to go into real estate, and that created that opportunity for that developer. And they said the other 20% of their money was going to go over here into venture capital, and that did this. So can you talk to us a little bit about that and the vantage point you have on the way in which sort of the movement of resources and assets create entire ecosystems and how we can be better at ensuring that those around us are able to participate in those ecosystems?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. So from if I'm speaking from my North Rock perspective, that's exactly what we do. When we think about a client or a family that we bring on board, you know, we start, the basis is cash flow. And this is what I talked about when I talked to NARAB. It's like, because you're working on a commission base, you have inconsistent cash flow. So how do we make sure the base of the pyramid, the cash flow, is consistent? And we start to have metrics to be able to measure that. But when I'm working with a family, think about the cash flow. And then the next step is like, how do I think about my global asset management strategy? So if you have a family business, you participate some in the capital markets with your qualified assets, which is like your IRAs, your 401ks, and all of those different things. Then you have your non-qualified assets, which is like your brokerage account and all those assets. But then you have a bucket of money that's going into alternative investments or to the private market. And this is where families really create exponential wealth because you get to outperform with the alpha. Now, there is some what we call liquidity risk, meaning that your money is going to be locked up for a period of time. But these people have, you know, a significant amount of wealth. So it's not so much about the money. It's about the impact and all the different things that they can do with their money and how they get the long-term return to be able to pass it from Gen 1 to Gen 2.
You just walked through an asset allocation across things. And you said there's, I don't know what you said, securities, cash. Can you break that down like really kind of layman's terms? Yeah. When you say we're going to put this much into the equity markets and the alternative investments, can you kind of like give us like a basic spread?
Right, because many of us lost you
at Hillel.
Sorry.
So, yeah.
I apologize. Okay, so let me back up. So when I think about a global asset management strategy, and I can use all three of you guys because you guys are business owners. So what I would think about is most of the time when I talk to people in real estate who are running a team, who own a brokerage, or even developers, most of their wealth is going to be concentrated in that one specific thing. They're constantly taking their profits and reinvesting back into the business, which you have to do to be able to scale. But what that does is they think they're really risk averse when they then start looking at their portfolio. So they may have like a portfolio that's in the stock market. So some stocks, some bonds, and they're looking at that. But when I look at your overall asset management strategy, I'm looking at your business. I'm looking at your portfolio, which is like, you know, whatever you have in stocks and bonds. And then I'm also looking at your own personal private investments, whether that may be your home, your secondary home. And then I'm saying, okay, what is your risk appetite across all of your assets? And that's where I think people have siloed views of each of those. So if I take your business and I say, okay, you're reinvesting this much in your business, how do I separate you from your business in the long term, not only tactically, but strategically? So if I think about all three of you guys, what is the plan to exit the business? Is it to succeed it and sell it to some other members? Is it to make an exit? And then what role do you play in that? Because many times as the principal partner, you are in the business. We have to be able to remove the business to get it a multiple so we can sell that business or really make an exit on it. So that's like one strategy for somebody like you three. But that's like for really every real estate agent. You're your own business. Yeah, so how right. do you think about that?
And that, you know why I smiled, PJ, because Unc just asked me that question today. I called him. Like I said, I called him with all my problems. I'm certain I owe him a sizable amount of money for therapy fees at this point. But I called him to tell him about my problems. And his first question was, what's the exit strategy, you know? And let's start with that in mind. So that's why I smiled when you said that, because we just had this conversation. Yeah.
So you just validated me. In other words, my stock just went up.
Yeah. Continue,
Unc,
PJ.
Unc is valuable out here. Unc is valuable out here. Unc is valuable out here. But I think it's right, because so many of us are caught in the moment of working and grinding so hard. But, you know, we have to think about, how do we operate with the end in mind and then reverse engineer and work backwards? And then that will tell us what kind of risk we need to take, what kind of returns we need to take, how much cash flow we need to get to where we want. And so I always pose these questions for every business owner. What does the end look like and how do you plan to exit? Okay, that's one. And then what does freedom look like to you? Financial freedom. If you were to exit this, what do you need in terms of assets to be able to be free? And freedom is different for everybody. Freedom is different for everybody. But how I'm defining freedom is, how can I have enough conservative or passive assets to take care not only of my living expenses, but my lifestyle?
Right.
Then you're free.
Yeah.
Because now you don't have to trade your time for money. And so we back into that of what that looks like. Maybe some people may not ever get there, or maybe that's not their definition. But then how can a portion of your passive assets be able to cover your lifestyle and living expenses? Then you kind of get there a little bit more. Go ahead, Bo.
I'm still like at the high level, right? At the high level, when you implement strategies, I think you were kind of breaking this down. When you implement strategies for these high net worth individuals or families, you look at this allocation. So yep. You were starting to do that, breaking it down for us. So let's say most of our listeners, a lot of them have a real estate business or some other sort of business that they're operating, right? And that's probably their main source of income,
yep.
right? And you talked a little bit about, okay, so you got your main source of income. Maybe you have an allocation to some, I think you said qualified assets, non-qualified assets, equity, and alternative investments. So in the light of person who owns a real estate team,
yep.
I'm making money from my real estate team. How would you challenge me to think about that allocation of resources?
That continuum, yep. So then the very next question I would be is, okay, how are we saving for that future Beau and your future family uh-huh. in terms of not just the business, but when we talk about qualified accounts? So are you maximizing your SEP IRA? Is that a strategy? How many employees do you got? Because SEP IRA is not the best vehicle if you have a lot of employees. Mm-hmm. Or are you a solo 401k? Because the goal is, what these are called qualified accounts, meaning accounts where you can put money in. The government has created these different vehicles where you can stick a bunch of money in, get tax-free growth, and sometimes take them out tax-free or take them out with little taxes as possible because you're in a different tax bracket when you're able to reach those assets. So that would be the next question I would ask somebody like you, Bo. What are your qualified accounts? Because you're not working for a company with a 401k. Now, if you were a corporate leader, then I would be thinking about, okay, what are your qualified stock options? What is your 401k plan? And then mapping that out. Because the goal is, when you talk about the long term and exiting all of this, how do we get you as much tax-free income coming in as possible and get that money to those buckets? So that would be like the different buckets. It'll be IRA, solo 401k, SEP IRA for a small business owner. And you can do some.
So I got a business. So
yep, I got the business.
I got my qualified assets. What's next?
Yep. Then the next will be your non-qualified assets, which will be your brokerage account. So then how are we allocating in the brokerage account? So you've already contributed to your retirement. You've made your money to your business. Now the thing is, how can I get some of my discretionary cash, which we call, to then be working for me? So then I put a portion of that, whatever that is, into my non-qualified accounts. But your qualified accounts and your non-qualified accounts, so your 401ks, all of that, and then your brokerage account need to be acting in unison, because it's about asset placement. Meaning this, your qualified accounts are taxed, or non-qualified accounts are taxed. So your brokerage account, if I buy a stock in there and then I need to sell that stock, I'm going to pay capital gains on there, whether short-term or long-term, right? But if I put that stock into a qualified account, it's going to grow tax-free. So asset placement is very key, and we talk about that. So when a client brings us their portfolio, reviewing all of their assets, where they are, then we start to look at, okay, here's what you have. Now, where do we place that to be most tax efficient in the long term? So that next bucket would be your non-qualified account, your brokerage account. And then in the long term, when you get in retirement, that's where we pull your assets from first, because that's going to be the tax. And those are conservative assets, mostly bonds. Bonds is where you take from your conservative asset. And I know we're getting very technical, so if this is too technical.
Home Team Inspection Service is changing the way agents and clients experience home inspections. Their team-based model, streamlined scheduling, and bundled packages, including home inspection warranties, make the process smoother from contract to closing. And with Pay at Close available in many locations, you can give your buyers more peace of mind with less upfront cost. Choose the team that works with yours. Visit hometeam.com to learn more.
No, I was just trying to get those buckets. So we got business, we got tax advantage qualified, we got non-qualified, and then what else?
Private markets.
We got private investments. And a lot of times what a lot of our listeners think about as investments is what in a broader asset allocation would be a smaller part, which they would call private investments. And that would so what would a private investment be, PG?
So private investments are everything that's not traded on the public markets.
So these are things that are not publicly traded
commodities.
Companies.
So it could be commodities, private investments, private companies, real estate, different, tech, venture, private equity, early venture, all of those things are qualified, what we say, alternative investments that are not publicly traded companies. There's a wide range of that.
I think that's super helpful. Just to recap that, if people are thinking about their asset allocation, you could think about it in light of, I've got my primary business or the thing that I'm running, which some people that's income, sometimes W-2, sometimes it's a business. For a lot of our listeners, it's an independent business that they've created.
Yep.
I have qualified assets, which are tax advantage things that can grow that prepare me for the future. Yep. I've got non-qualified assets, which are typically publicly traded stocks, bonds, accounts. These are just trading the stock market or buying municipal bonds or something like that. And then I have private investments, which would be investments I might make in private companies, in real estate, any other thing that's outside sort of a publicly traded asset class. And so that's a way that even at a very early stage, someone could start to think about their financial world.
Yes.
In those buckets.
So, PJ, I got that breakdown. We already know, or we have a strong idea, that there are a lot of people that have not started anything yet.
Yep.
So how do we start from dirt?
So the first thing I would say is, do you have, so you got your main income, do you have an emergency fund? So that's got to be the first thing. How do I get, you know, a couple months, 3 months of saving? Because most real estate agents have our commission base. And as we know, 2020 was tough. 2021 was always going to be bad, but it was most people's best year. The market went crazy. Interest rates went up. Now, these last couple of years, it's been slow motion. There's been some legislative changes. So then how do we make sure you at least have a safety net? That'll be first, like a couple months set aside for when I don't have consistent income. So that's the first.
I'm going to jump in there because this past weekend I did a presentation in Dallas and one of my slides said that 40% of Americans do not have enough money to cover a $400 emergency without borrowing. And the audience said, no, ma'am, 80%. Maybe it's 40% of Americans, but this was, of course, a Black audience that I was speaking to. And they said, well, no, 80% of us don't have $400 in case of emergency. We'd have to borrow that from somebody. And so I think that's a good starting place right there, because what that means is we're talking to somewhere between 40 and 80% of the people listening to this podcast do not have step one.
Yes, that's step one. You got to have some money put away because, unfortunately, like we all know, a rainy day always comes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A rainy day always comes. Nothing ever goes as planned. So we know that for sure. And things come up. So I would got to get a couple months set aside where if something happened, you have enough money to cover you while you try to figure it out. That's step one. Then step two is say, okay, I got that. Now, how do I then save for my future? And, you know, when I'm talking to somebody, I would pose these questions as I'm talking to your audience. So after that emergency fund, then what are my goals, not only short term, midterm, and long term? Because I don't want to put no money into a Roth IRA or IRA, some kind of retirement account, if I'm going to need it in a couple years. Because all I'm just going to do is get hit with penalties. So, but you do want your money to be working for you. So think about that. So the next one would be like, how do I invest in whatever my company is offering? So if I'm working for a company in a 401k and make that a percentage and get used to putting a percentage in there. So it could be small, 5%, 10%, even less than that. Just do whatever you feel comfortable with so you have enough cash flow to continue to live. Now, if I don't have a company that has that, then I need to think about opening an IRA, a SEP IRA, or a solo 401k so that I can put some money away for myself and it can work for me. Because as we all know, there's only so much time that you can trade your time for money. You got to eventually, you're not going to be able to work no more. And you're going to need some, you know, that savings that you have done and been diligent about over the years to start to kick in for you.
Sometime, at some point, you won't just trade time and talent for money. You need your money to do some of the heavy lifting. And over time, we've got to move because, I don't know, I'm getting older and tired, or maybe it's just me. But I feel like I need that money to do a little more heavy lifting for me now because I'm getting tired.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if I'm talking from our community, you know, the genesis of it is like, how do we change our perspective of money? And money is not going to define you. It's just a tool. And it just makes you more of what you are. So if you're a giving person, the more money you have, it'll just magnify that. If you were an a-hole before, you get more money, then you type Kanye West in, you know? Yeah. So it just makes you more of who you are. So I think our relationship as a community with money needs to be changed. It's not, it says in the Bible, the money is the root of all evil. It's what you do with the money, because it's the only thing that can compete with God in that sense. So like, it's not a bad thing to have wealth and have a level of it. Now what you do with it and how you use it and as a tool then becomes the thing for us.
And you broke that down. That was a great way to break it down. And you have this money saved up. You have a reserve fund. You have 6 months reserve fund. What do you do? And I'm going to ask a question particularly because this conversation has come up a lot. index funds, life insurance, index life insurance. I get that question a lot from people. Give some feedback on that, because that's a big thing, because we have these newfound financial advisors that are giving people that advice. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So maybe there was like two layers of questions in there. I think everybody should have a level of insurance. I've watched families be able to pass wealth through insurance. And so I'll give my own personal example of what we do in my family, and then that'll help you give genesis. So when I was working at Wells Fargo Private Bank, I had a client who had passed away, and the kids and the mother came in. And, you know, they were distraught, but we were talking about it. And the lady had said, well, this is a tool for wealth building that we use in our family. So every member of the family has a level of insurance on them. And so then when they pass away, then that money goes into the family bucket. And so I was like, wow, I never heard of that. Right. Because one thing is inevitable. We're all going to pass away at some point. So insurance is very valuable in building wealth and from a tax-free perspective for families. So what me and my sister have done is we have taken insurance policies out on all of the generation above us, so my mom and dad, all their brothers and sisters, and even a generation after that, and then vowed that we will never spend the money when somebody passes away. That money will go into our family trust, and that's how we will build the base of the wealth for the family. And then with the goal of that trust building, but being able to do things like, you know, when you get married, I had to pay for my own wedding. My mom and dad just didn't have enough money. Boom. I want to be able, if you get married, to pay that. If you want to buy your own first home, I had to put my own down payment. How can that go? If you want to start a business and you're, you know, trying to get going, how can a trust help you do those different things that I think our other counterparts, other races have done and have the wealth to be able to do, but we don't. So insurance is a very valuable tool. So that's one thing. Index insurance and the kind of insurance, that it's all individual based. So I don't want to generalize it, but it's individual based. So I'll talk about my own personal situation. So what I do is I have enough insurance to not only pay for all of my kids to go to school, because I have three kids, to be able to go to school, for my wife to be able to pay off the house, and then for her to be able to live for at least 10 years so she can grieve and then hopefully find another man who can take care of her and keep it going. You know what I'm saying? But that's kind of how I have thought about it. I don't want to overinsure and overindex into insurance because I still want to enjoy some of my money, but I want to have enough insurance that if something was to happen to me, it builds a level of wealth so they don't have to start all over, which a lot of us have done when people pass away. We left with freaking bills rather than a jump start.
So wait, I want to clarify, because we jumped around a little bit. You were on a 1-2 path and we went to insurance. You had said if somebody's just getting started from dirt was Imrig's question. And you said first an emergency fund. Then you said an IRA or a SEP. And then was number three the insurance? Did we just skip something?
The insurance is kind of like built in there as well. So like if you have a family, there's definitely should be a level of insurance to be able to cover just the main assets or replace your income for a certain amount of years if you're the main breadwinner.
Sure.
So that's kind of layered in there. And you can do a whole life, which is much more expensive. So a lot of people can't afford that right at the beginning. So I would get just a simple term policy. Doesn't have to be a lot, but enough to be able to cover you, your costs, and be able to leave your family with some kind of money just in case you pass away. And then I think the next would be then putting a portion of your money in a brokerage account to work for you. And we need to be thinking about when we get our income, our paycheck, our 1099, whatever that is, the first thing should be, how do I take a portion of my money and make it work for me? That's the first part. The second part is paying living expenses. And then the last part is whatever left can go to quality of life, which I think many of our people, and not just our people, young people a lot have it backwards. Quality of life is first. How do I spend on my quality of life? Whatever's left, I'm going to pay all my living expenses. And then if I may or may not have none, and then I may or may not save, that has to be flipped. That's how wealthy people are thinking. The money is, if it's your number one employee, that mother effer needs to always be working.
Mm-hmm. I think that those are simple enough paths that people can take to ask themselves those questions. Before we got into, you know, all of what you do at a family office, the first steps are, those are kind of the basics, right?
Basics.
Get an emergency fund, set up an IRA, 401k, S&P, whatever you're doing there. You definitely need insurance. It can just be term, and then you can get fancy with it, right?
Yeah.
Start doing whole life. And then a brokerage account. And then we talk about quality of life. And then also in that, we can level up basically and start talking about those additional things you were previously talking about with like the family office and all of those things. But once we start there.
Yeah. And I think that gives you a good base. And that base is actually the same for if you have, you know, $1,000 in your account or if you have $300 or $400 million in your account. Those are the basics. They're the same for really everybody. Now, the level of complexity inside of those just differs. But that basic, that foundation is for everybody. And that's how you should be thinking about your money. Save a little, spend a little, give a little. Like, very simple principle that you should be thinking. Your bucket, your money should be in those buckets. And I say give a little because, and I think we all can agree with this, if you're sowing back into whether it's your church, your community, your friends, that is seeds that you're planting. The only way to get that, reap that harvest is to plant those. Mm. So a portion of your money should go to planting and sowing seed into others, other communities. And for me, 10% of all of my assets go to my church. My church is very small. I'm probably giving more than everybody in the congregation combined. I don't ask no questions about what they do it to me. God told me to give. I'm going to give mine. He gave me 100%. All he asking for 10% back. I'm going to do that. So however that is for you, whatever that is, I would encourage people to take a small portion of their money and start sowing that seed because that's how it comes back to you.
I just wanted to come back to the family office because we went from one way to the other way. Just so we can be clear, what is there like a barrier to entry when you start talking about a family office? Is there a certain net worth? Is there something? How does one get into that?
So maybe let me do then maybe a little bit more definition. So there's a difference between a single family office, which means you have one family, which was created by John D. Rockefeller. He created this because he wanted his money to be able to last. So then he hired an investment professional, a tax attorney. He hired his own CPA, an accountant, all for just work on his family's wealth. And so that's a single family office. What I'm at is a multifamily office. So the people who can't pay each of these people individually don't have enough assets. So to stand up a single family office, you need probably about a couple $100 million. What I'm at the level of is a multifamily office. So meaning you have similar families who have similar values, but don't need a full CPA to hire as themselves of their own, but need a portion of that to be able to do their family taxes, business taxes. And so you share these services with other like-minded families who are doing it. And so our minimums are $3 million in investable assets, not net worth, investable assets. So there's a difference between that, meaning you can have $500,000 or $600,000 in your account and have a home that's worth a couple $1 million, but that's not a liquid asset. So $3 million of investable assets, meaning you're paying about $30,000 a year annually in fees. So it's a big jump. It's a different. But for that level of fee, the amount of services and the depth and breadth that you get are a lot because this is how we build our personal family office. So you're going to get two advisors, which are like CFPs or planners. So they're going to do your planning. You're going to get a client service person who's going to handle all your day-to-day your wires and any transactions that you may have. You're going to get a tax professional who's going to handle all of the tax. You're going to get an investment professional who's going to build an investment thesis based off of your goals and what your family wants to be able to do. You're going to a banking and bill pay person because we provide every family and every individual that we work with a cash flow report and the P&L every month. So you know where every single dollar is going. You have no guess about where every dollar is going. You're going to have an insurance professional to make sure that not only your simple insurance, your property casualty, your life, but all the other insurances. If you have a business like you guys have, your buy-sell agreements and all that are in order. You're going to have an estate attorney, which is the final step of your financial plan, meaning how do I plan for the end and how do I plan to pass assets? So you're going to have 8 people, and then you're going to have a philanthropic person. So a person who's dedicated to helping you and your family think about your philanthropic legacy and how you give to community and how your family shows up in a giving aspect. So you're going to have a team of 8 people that are integrated in working around you and your family based on the goals, not only short-term, but long-term, with the goal to grow wealth and pass that, which is very robust. Not everybody needs that level of service if you don't have a certain level of complexity and assets.
So can you come with your own people? What if you already have a tax guy and a finance guy? Can you come with your own people?
Yeah, definitely. So we can integrate them in however you want, because our goal is not to disrupt great relationships that are working, but it's to simplify and magnify right. and grow. So if you have people that are great, the issue that we find most of the time, and here's where it is. So if you have your financial advisor at this firm and you're working with him, he can't really see the whole picture. You have your CPA here
right.
who's doing a lot of the stuff. You have your attorney here, but you're caught in the middle trying to execute between all right. of these people. So for somebody like Unc, who's got 600, you know, agents under him, he's running a whole business, he's got 10 people who's working directly under him, employed at the brokerage firm, I don't have time to call my CPA, call my philanthropic person to get them to coordinate. I need one person to call mm-hmm. who can then organize this. Or the bigger question for somebody like all of you three is, if something was to happen, who's the one person that your significant other can call who knows everything that's moving?
Yeah. Right. That's a good question.
I know we're getting to the end here, but one of the takeaways I have just listening to this, if you really simplify it, it's that all of us have a business or a job that we do every day. I don't think we often think about wealth building or our wealth as a job, as an exercise. And mm-hmm. I think if I was taking away one thing from today, it's that you've got the job of the business of your business, but there's a business of your family. There's a business of your life. There's a business of your yes. legacy. And that business is worthy of your attention the same way the business you do every day is.
I'm writing that down, bro, because how you articulated that was very beautiful, because I think every family should be operating like a business. Then you maximize it. And I think you have to pay attention to how you build a governance structure, meaning what are our values of our families, and have these conversations intergenerational. What do we think about a capital structure and how we grow our money? And what are you doing for your business? What am I doing in mine? And talking about those things. And then how do we show up as an organization, as a family, philanthropically? Mm-hmm. That's the conversations that our wealthy families are having quarterly that, you know, all the other people are not having. They're just going and letting life happen to them instead of being intentional about shaping that.
Thank you. You obviously are a wealth of knowledge. You are very invested in what you do and in the community. Of course, as vice president of the Minneapolis NAACP and several other nonprofits, economic empowerment is clearly important to you, and empowering all of us is important to you. What do you think would be the one thing that you would want somebody listening to this episode to take away from all of the things that you've said?
It probably resonates with both. Number one, you deserve to be wealthy and you deserve to have the finer things in life to see how good this life can get. And number two, in deserving that, I think you should put the time in to be intentional about all of your assets and what you do and building a plan. Don't let life just happen to you. Be intentional about wealth building and becoming financially savvy in your financial literacy. And because we have technology, it's the great equalizer. You can go on YouTube and you can really learn anything. I have a couple of friends, Troy and Rashad. They have a podcast called Earn Your Leisure and a whole credible platform. Mm-hmm. They're disseminating free information. Like, just be curious and pursue those things. The most successful mm-hmm. people are the most curious. I watched some of you guys' other episode. You guys had Jay on the other day. And what he said is he just has a tremendous curiosity for growing in different things. Mm-hmm. I think that curiosity is the base of how you start to change things in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you. How could somebody reach you if they have more questions or they want more information or they want to set up a family office? How do they get a hold of you, PJ?
Yeah. So I'm on Instagram. So my Instagram is Mr.PJHill, and I try to post a lot of things that people can really help. I post also my, you know, my personal life on there. And then, or they can reach out to me via email at northrock@pj.hill@northrockpartners.com. And, you know, doesn't matter the amount of assets you have, I'm willing to invest in a lot of people. This is my gift to the world. God has blessed me beyond belief. And so now I'm pouring out into others.
Well, PJ, thank you so much for being here. And thank you all out there in the listening world for tuning in to another fabulous episode of the Color of Money podcast. We'll catch you next week. Follow the Color of Money podcast today and get notified when new episodes are released weekly.
Be part of this transformative listening experience.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not Keller Williams Realty LLC and its affiliates, and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.